Moncrief on News Talk.
Joanna Fortune is with us once again. Good afternoon,
Joanna. Good afternoon, Sean.
This is not unrelated to the topic we were just talking about, but that's more about adults having rows on holidays.
Yeah.
But during the holiday period, and this seems to be kind of there's been a few articles about this recently, that it's if there's a parent at home, either ferrying them to and back to camps, or getting what are we doing today, or can I have?
It's exhausting.
It's and like you can burn out.
It is, and I think this topic of parental burnout is back in the media now because somebody's done some research, you know, and research is always. But actually, parental burnout is not a new concept, Sean. It's been around for as long as I can remember. I frequently work with parents who are coming in a state of burnout. And I think it's an act of courage if you can reach out and seek help saying I'm not coping. And when we talk about burnout, I know people listening might go, oh, gosh, yes, that's me. It's different to what I would call low stamina days, like parental low stamina. I mean, I think that's very relatable. We can all kind of say, yes, we've been there. It's usually a Thursday, you know, every week when you're just tired, but you know, two or three good nights sleep would really sort you out, or a small little break away from the kids or whatever it is, time out with your friends would just reset you. And we have those low parental stamina days. And I can put something up actually on my social media later on this, but I have this little section of play I often do with people called armchair play for those days when you just don't want to get out of your armchair. We'll still get you playing. You know, I have a whole set of activities that you can do without getting up, and you can have your cup of tea while sitting there. Small bit of planning and structure and it works. So low parental stamina is something to be anticipated and expected. And it now not to be ignored. It's usually the first sign for us that, you know, you're not taking care of yourself and you're not minding yourself and your body, your energy levels are letting you know. But parental burnout is a more chronic, pervasive version of that. So it's not something a couple of good night's sleep or a night out with your friends is going to sort out. It's something that has really gotten in on you, and it is affecting the emotional and relational quality of your connection with your children. It can often, how it comes to me is sometimes a parent will say, and again, I really respect this as an act of courage to be able to say this to somebody, I don't think I love my kids.
Yeah, and like, that must be off because
awful,
now,
awful.
Even though, like, probably it's a thought that's gone through the heads of most parents, but it's not, it's kind of like, you don't want to say that out loud.
Oh,
what's wrong with me?
It takes huge courage to say that out loud. But if you can say it out loud in a safe place with an appropriate professional, you can get help with this. And it is possible to get help because not always, but mostly, and I do want to emphasize mostly, it's not about I don't love my kids. It's about I don't love who I am when I'm with my kids.
Yeah.
It's a different sentence and a different sentiment. And then we can look at, well, what is being activated in you in this role of parenting? Where has that come from? You know, we're all immersed in comparison culture these days. You know, it's you don't have to go anywhere but your phone to decide you've got a whole array of people you can compare yourself to. And I know our logic brains go, it's not real and it's not realistic, but enough of it over and over and over will get in there and give you that little niggly whisper in your brain, I'm not doing it as well or as right as other people. I'm failing. And that repeated reinforced sense of failure is going to affect your parental esteem, your stamina, and then chronically, pervasively, that becomes burnout.
Yeah.
So it is, like, I think the hope with this, and I do think the new research that's coming out backs this up as well, and it's my own anecdotal clinical experience, it is entirely possible to work with this. You can turn this around. It's not like, we always talk about burnout in jobs, don't we? You know, I'm exhausted, burnt out, and you can go to your GP and get written off and get time off and take care of yourself and prescribed work. You can't get written off from parenting.
Yes.
And that's part of the problem. Like, it really is.
Wow, it'd be nice if you could.
Wouldn't it? A little hiatus, hit pause button, but you can't. You can't switch jobs when it comes to parenting. So it is about getting professional help. So don't take it lightly if you're hearing this or have read some of those articles with that research cited in it and you're thinking, I think it's me. I'm completely burnt out in this. Help is available. It is possible. And, you know, you're talking now, it's not sitting down with somebody 4 to 6 times is going to turn that around. I want to be realistic, but it's also not years and years of endless therapy.
Yeah.
It is possible to address it and to do it very effectively and in a way that could be sustained ongoing. So small changes make big differences, but everybody's deserving of help with that. I think it's great that we have the opportunity to explore it and talk about it more and give people permission to feel how they feel.
Yeah, because I suppose the difficulty is that you're coming out of a situation that's literally doing your head in. You might go for a bit of respite, talk to a professional, but then you go back into it again.
But you want to go back into it with a fresh thinking, new perspective. So it is about the process is about engaging that reflective functioning piece so that when you go back in, it's not like you're going in, oh, here we go again. You're going in going, okay, I know what I can anticipate and I have some options that I can apply here.
Mm, yeah. Right. I'm sure this question has been asked several times before. My 12 and a half year old son wants a phone. He's the last in the class. We've also heard that one before, too. He's getting upset that he doesn't have one and feels very left out. We both, his parents, have been holding out as we both feel that computers should not be given to children. We feel totally unsupported, I suppose, and are feeling the pressure to give in to him because it's getting much tougher than I thought it would to hold out any longer. I teach digital skills to secondary school students. I see the effects that phones and the content they have are exposed to can have on teenagers. And I suppose I'm just upset at the thought of him having access to all that now. I can and will teach him safety and digital well-being, etc., and have rules in place. Is that really all I can do?
Look, he has access to that world when you as parents give him access. That's the long and short of it.
Yeah.
The last child at 12 and a half, I find that kind of sad, Sean. I believe them, by the way, but I do think it's sad if every other 12-year-old has a phone. Like, we are talking about trying to delay the point of access to this technology simply because it's not necessary for their age group. It does get in the way of other play patterns, and it's something they can engage with when they are neurologically, psychosocially, emotionally mature enough to do so. If you feel your 12 and a half year old ticks all those boxes, then they're exceptional and go forth. But if not, have the confidence in all of this. As parents, you're saying, we really feel computers should not be given to children. That's the answer. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
So if you as parents had said, we're not going to give our child access to social media or smart technology of their own until whatever, 14, 15, 16, whatever it is, until then, actually, this is now the pressure point. This is where you have to hold your boundary. Because when they were 8, 9 and 10, it was easy to say, oh, it'll be 14 and I believe it and I'm going to hold it. But now is when the pester power comes on. Now is when it's everybody else but me. Now is when you're being tested.
Yeah,
so this is about holding that. And I think it does take parents setting and holding age boundaries around smartphones to bring about change and to bring about a collective change. It's a collective effort is what I mean. And this parent, you know, you're talking to teenagers in secondary school about this technology. You're immersed in this world. So set and hold.
They know better than most.
Absolutely. Yeah. Set and hold your no, believe in yourself and set the boundaries you want for your child. Doesn't mean they're going to high five you and you're not going to be popular with this. But if you know in your professional and personal capacity, it is right to delay his point of access further than 12 and a half, then that is the answer. The teaching, by the way, about digital, about safety, digital well-being, you know, what this parent does as a job, that's great, but it should happen now. It should happen well before the phone is in his hand.
Absolutely.
So it's not that you will teach him about it, it's that you are teaching him about it, and that is taught and repeated 3 times. So it's embedded for him before he gets the phone, that you watch him on your phone or an old phone, whatever way you want to do that, for very set, rigid periods of time, handing it back. How does he abide by those rules, guidelines, that you're practicing this and that you put in place terms like a little contract, terms of this is how it can be used. These are the consequences for breach of this. And again, you are consistent, predictable and follow through on that. It's very easy to kind of go, yes, I'll do all of that. But you have to put it into practice and then hold the boundary. I think setting boundaries, Sean, is a lot easier than holding them, especially with these preteen, teenage, because they're doing what they're supposed to do, which is to test, defy, push against our boundaries. It's exactly what they're supposed to do developmentally. It's on us to hold them gently yet firmly in place.
Yeah. Indeed, we interviewed someone a few months ago. There's a town in England where all the schools in the town decided to do exactly that. That I forget what the ages were, but it certainly was 14 before you got anywhere near a phone.
Yeah, I think it was 14. Yeah.
And the head teacher were organised. It was really striking when he said, you know, and this was a year ago, more than a year ago, they did that, and that he had noticed that children were learning to play with each other again, which was.
Because like, play is relational.
I know, but like how, you know, how poignant is that?
But it's so important. And I think we forget that teenagers need to play as well. We think, oh, play is for little kids, and we can imagine what it looks like. Play is a relational activity that fuels connection. Teenagers need that arguably as much as small children need it. But it's not always as easy for them to migrate to it, because play is a bit harder for them to access unless it's made accessible, appealing and inviting for them. So anything that fuels connection is what we should be investing in. And anything that gets in the way of that, put a pause on it and delay the point of access.
Yeah. Just going back to that question about parental burnout. One texter says Germany has an interesting option for parental burnout, a form of preventative or therapeutic spa treatment, often covered by health insurance, that can be prescribed by a doctor.
Oh, I love that. And I love if that's specifically named for parental burnout. That's fantastic.
Yeah. I'm really struggling to decide whether to send my second daughter to primary school this September at 4.5 years or hold off for another year. She's completed 2 years of Ecky, and we started her early with the intention of sending her this year. However, as the time draws closer, I'm more and more unsure. She's quite mature, both socially and emotionally, managing well in social situations, making friends, understanding things like turn-taking, sharing, following simple instructions, etc., and is independent in terms of putting on her shoes and coats, etc. She's able to communicate and express her own feelings and emotions, but does not cope well with being reprimanded or disciplined if she's done something she's not supposed to, and often breaks down in tears. Her older sister started school at 4 years and 7 months, also quite early, mm-hmm. and has thrived both socially and academically, often surpassing her peers, the majority of whom are a bit older than her. However, although there's only 2 years between them, they're very different, with my youngest displaying more babyish behaviours at times, particularly since her baby brother arrived last year. If she were to start this year, a number of her classmates would be up to 13 months older than her, and it's a small class of about 10 kids. I feel she would cope fine, but my fear is for the years to come and on into secondary school, given they're all confronted with nowadays. Any advice would be greatly appreciated.
This is so related. This is the time of year for these questions,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and the reality is there isn't an absolute clear cut, this is the perfect age for a child to start school, because no two children are the same.
Yeah.
And you really have to go, like, exactly like this parent is saying, my other child, 4 and 7 months, flying it, no bother to them, they're grand. This child, in the opening bit of this letter, I was like, gosh, she sounds really ready, you know, like this child is flying it and it all sounds okay. But then you describe her being kind of babyish and I'm like, so she's gone from being emotionally ready and mature to babyish. So there's a contradiction in this. And there's two ways of looking at it, Sean. You know, emotional readiness is what matters most. Okay, you know, it's very difficult. And any parent, and I speak to a lot of parents at this time of year about this, where they have a child who's very bright, very able, is going to fly it with the curriculum. You do have to balance that out with the emotional readiness. This child is sounding, in the opening of this letter, very ready in a lot of those regards. And a lot of the ways that we measure, can they do this, this and this for themselves? So if you feel she is emotionally ready, then but she's having this wobble since her brother came, that's very context specific. Who was your youngest child, now the middle child, to emotionally regress with a new baby coming into the family is not unusual. It's transient regression and it's context specific. But you could see that she goes into big school with kids who are a little old, some of them significantly older, some of them a little older than her. They won't all be 13 months older, for example. She could thrive. She could actually mature upwards to match their level. And you could say, gosh, that was a great decision that we put her in there. And then you could put her in and she could be like, overwhelmed, these kids are way ahead of me and I'm not able to keep up. So in one way, it'd be lovely if you could dip your toe in and kind of put them in for two weeks and see, did that work? But that's not the way it is. There's no right or wrong. You know her. Trust your gut with this. And I would also ask her Ekie teachers. They've had her for 2 years now. They've seen her go through transitions. They've seen her learning capacity, her capacity to task complete, task engage, to manage transitions in and out. To, you know, they've seen all of that, and they will give you a really good take on her. They prepare kids to transition to school all the time. I think it would be well worth a conversation there. I do understand this question about she's ready now for primary school. Will she be ready for secondary school? That's a whole other conversation, because we can't predict that. You could have a child who does really well in primary school and then really struggles with the transition to secondary school.
But but I can see she's thinking that maybe this child might be 10 and a half or 11 going to secondary school, which is awfully young.
Yeah, she'd probably be the 11 and a half-ish. Like, she's 4 and a half. She's probably 6 months younger than other kids going to school. But her sister, give or take.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
And the other thing, Sean, is it's a small class. There's only 10 children in the class.
So that will make it easier,
so
absolutely.
That's something quite... Now, again, I was curious about that. Does that mean junior infants are blended in with senior infants and first class? Do you know, like, is it one of those shared classroom? Because 10 children is a very small school. Mm. But also, if they're getting that kind of level of input and attention, that could be really helpful as well.
Yeah.
I would talk to the teachers. I would say, you know, if you feel, when you do your list with this, and you might be a list parent when I read your letter, because you've gone through things bit by bit. So if you're a list parent, do your list in terms of, is the balance, you know, certainly at a minimum, 2/3 ready for school. If you're only 50-50, keep her back.
Yeah, yeah. Good way of looking at it. My 15-year-old son is quirky, fun, kind and sensitive, but unfortunately, he's a tendency to lie. When he does something wrong, he never owns it and always denies and deflects. And his version of stories can be completely, extremely convincing. We have a very close relationship, but I'm so disappointed that these lies are continuing. No matter what his dad and I say to him, I get regular calls from the school, and as they say, he just owned up to the wrongdoing. The issue could be dealt with a lot quicker, but his denials and fabrications escalate everything. None of his actions are sinister, more behavioural, like talking too much, ripping out a page of his school journal if he gets a bad note from his teacher and then denying it. The latest was nipping into a room at school, which is a no-go zone for students, where there were biscuits for examiners. He took a few packets and hid them underneath his school top. He was caught red-handed on the school's cameras. We issue different kinds of consequences with him at home, but none of them seem to work. I know he's a great kid, but this trait of his is very worrying. What is the best way to deal with this?
That's so interesting, because they're not the cleverest of lies.
No, they're
you
not.
Know, like there's something a little bit clumsy about them.
Yeah.
You know, especially going into that room where he may as well have gone in with a big neon arrow over his head. It's me, I'm doing this. And that to me is relevant, because is this lying or is it impulsive behavior? You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, we look at lying in ways of, is it impulsive lying versus compulsive or pathological lying? Pathological lying is pervasive. You're lying about everything all the time and it's ongoing. This is definitely sounding more impulsive lying. And impulsive behavior and lying, by the way, tends to peak towards the end of middle childhood, coming into adolescence. So that kind of 12, 13, that age, it does. And it can continue, because impulsivity in the teenage brain is a factor all the time, because the part of their brain that develops so quickly is the impulsive do it, thrill-seeking, reward-oriented part of the brain. And the part of the brain that goes, you know, is that really such a good idea? Let's weigh up pros and cons. Really takes until mid to late 20s to fully mature, but it's grossly immature at this age. Now, this guy is sounding a little immature for 15.
Yeah.
So I do want to, and that's okay. Parents shouldn't panic about that, but he's sounding more 13 than 15 in how he's described here. And that heightened impulsivity in their brain neurologically, it can cause teenagers to lie for what are short-term benefits, the biscuits, not getting a note in my diary read, even though it has to be signed and the school are going to know I didn't sign. You know,
He's not thinking it through.
So those short-term benefits without considering consequences are there. So he's sounding emotionally immature to me. And it might be the approach is to build up maturity, independence, give him more of that responsibility, you know, taking responsibility and being accountable. And that isn't lecturing him. That's giving him chores, tasks, things that he is in charge of. He could do it some some kind of a job. He's 15. I know every parent out there with a long summer ahead of them is pulling their hair out. What am I going to do with my 15-year-old? But if he could go around even mowing lawns, to, you know, something that he's going to be responsible for. When you say you have a whole different kinds of consequences at home, I don't know what they are, but they should be logical. They should be consistent. So not just whimsically try this, try that, try anything. And I'm curious how he reacts when he's caught out and confronted. Do you see shame? Do you see remorse? Do you see any reflection where he's like, yeah, that wasn't the smartest decision? And I'm also curious, Sean, is he impulsive like this in other areas of his life?
You know, yeah, yeah.
Is this a kid who is generally impulsive? Because there just might be a bit more to that. I mean, yes, therapy can help with this type of stuff, just to say that it can be really helpful for teens to think all that stuff out loud, to work out boundaries in that way, because at that age, they tend to hear and take it more from a third party, like a therapist or a sports coach or some other grown up than their parents. And that is an option. But I think focus on maturity and responsibility in the now.
Yeah. We moved 2 years ago to a new area where the kids are generally 6 years old or younger, or teenagers. My daughter finally met a friend, also 11 and new to the area, at a community day, and they've been firm friends ever since. Sadly, we just heard that they're moving abroad. My daughter is so upset. Sadly, she's lost 3 good friends already in primary school to people moving away. One of these we've managed to keep in contact with, as they're still in Dublin, and we get them together on occasion for sleepovers, etc. I'm just so mindful that her experience is that all her friends seem to leave. And she was so upset when we had to tell her. How can we help her not internalise this pattern of feeling that friends eventually leave? She is in a local drama group, but again, the kids are on either side of her age group. She has one new pal there also, but not from the area. She's a sensitive soul. Any suggestions or support would be appreciated.
I think as parents, it's really important that you don't internalise either.
Yeah.
This pattern of friends leaving her. Because I'm wondering if that kind of, how can we help her not to internalise it? Where is that coming from? Has she said, oh my gosh, this is something friends do. You can't rely on friends. They always leave. Or are you concerned that this is happening for her?
Sure. Yes.
You know, and that's okay. Yeah, it would make sense if that's it, but it's really important that we look at that. There isn't a kind of neat way that you can teach her that's not, don't internalize those feelings. But actually, you can let her know she's not alone with those feelings. You can make sure that she's expressing those. And it is okay for her to be upset when she hears her good friend is moving away. That's a very logical, congruent expression of emotion in that context. So don't panic with that, and more empathize and accept that, yeah, it is sad. And of course you're crying. Let's explore ways you guys can maintain contact. It's really sad you won't have as much access to your friend. Mm. So you're not fixing it. You're not able to jump in and rescue her from these feelings. But what you can do is say you're not alone with them. She seems to be a kid who makes friends quite well, you know?
Yeah.
She doesn't have a lot of kids her age right around her. But where she does, she's pretty good at developing a relationship and sustaining it. There's one kid around, that's my buddy.
Yeah.
Now there's somebody in drama. So it sounds sensitive as she is, she's actually doing quite well. So as parents, you're clearly resourcing her enough that she can form connections wherever she has the opportunity to do so. You can't make kids her age be in the area, but she goes to school, she has activities, so you can nurture those connections. So as parents, and it's taking on a little bit more, given we started with parental burnout, it's taking on a bit more of that burden of facilitation, is that you may be longer in your car, bringing her to meet friends, facilitating play dates so that she can have those outside of school connections. But also hold in mind that she is in school all day, every day. She has plenty of social connection in that context. She has drama class. She has more social connection. If she doesn't have kids exactly around your house, it's okay.
Yeah, indeed. Just going back to that question we got about phones, and it's well worth pointing out, someone says it's not just kids that phones are stopping interaction. Our works canteen is deadly quiet as everyone is buried on their phones with no interaction with each other.
I think that's really sad. And I got the dart in to town today, and it's the exact same.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's just looking out the window, letting their mind wander anymore. Everybody was navel gazing into their phones.
Yeah. Or even walking along the street, staring at a phone, hypnotized. Joanna, thanks
so
much
for coming in
to us as ever. Joanna Fortune, there you are, listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. We're going to take a break. After that, how women's football has taken over the world.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.